Hello everyone, welcome back to our Acts 7 study. I hope you are all doing well at home and with all of the social distancing that we're doing right now. Sounds like we have this ahead of us for a while. It's hard to know how long. And I've noticed there are so many creative ideas and solutions that are cropping up, and I hope you're finding some of those to be helpful to you and making life a little bit more normal for you. My prayer is that while we're all taking care of our health, our physical health, that we're also making sure to take care of our spiritual well-being, staying up on the Bible studies and up on the teachings and getting together with God in prayer and with one another in God's spirit. When we can do that in prayer, that's also an enormous help and blessing to all of us. So we've had some really good teachings this week about that, and they're good ones to revisit if you need some encouragement or some ideas and inspiration. So I hope that that's all working out for you. So we are still looking at Stephen here in chapter 7 of the book of Acts and trying to understand why he brought out the things that he did to the Sanhedrin council from the well-known and shared history that they had together when he was accused of blaspheming the temple, the law, the customs of Moses, and all of these other things that we've discussed earlier. Tonight we're going to cover question number 2, part D, which is about Moses and the Hebrews in the wilderness, and I'm also hoping to address question 3, which asks what happened during the times that were covered by verses 42 and 43. I want to continue to use Stephen's summary in verses 51 and 53 to focus in on his train of thought. So, as I said last week, we are looking for the ways in which Stephen, what he recounts of the great and obedient faith of the forefathers that these council members claim, in contrast to the actions of other forefathers who, as we listed before, opposed God's spirit when it led them, persecuted those who brought God's word to them, and limited God to the law in the temple, meanwhile not obeying the law. So let's read verses 51 and 53 to just get that in our minds again real quickly. Because this is where Stephen ends up at the end of what he has to say to them. And so, it reads like these are the things that he has demonstrated to them with the rest of the speech, the parts that we are studying tonight. In verse 51, he says, "Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, ye do always resist the Holy Ghost, as your fathers did, so do ye, which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted? And they have slain them which showed before of the coming of the Just One, of whom ye have now been the betrayers and murderers." So we finished up last week in verse 35. So we're going to go back into Stephen's speech now, his response to the accusations that were brought against him. And in verse 35, we had by this time seen the faith with which Moses had followed God, and the God who had saved him in the river and had met him at the burning bush and had now brought him back to Egypt to do his work of delivering the people of Israel on God's behalf. But we also had already encountered the outright rejection of Moses by the Hebrews who were in bondage in Egypt. So we read that in verse 35, which we can read here again really quickly. So Acts 7, verse 35. "This Moses whom they refused, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge? The same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel that appeared to him in the bush." So we've looked here at the ways in which Stephen has described Moses thus far. And now starting in verse 36, he really gives us a sort of a brief recap of Moses' credentials, so to speak, a short list of the proofs that God had given to Moses and to the people to prove and that Moses was the chosen man for the work that God had, and that God had fully empowered him to do that work. So we're just going to kind of run through those here in verses 36 and 38. We'll read them. I'll read them first and then just go back to them a little bit. Verse 36 says, he, that being Moses, of course, he brought them out after that he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall ye hear. Verse 38, this is he, again Moses, that was in the church in the wilderness with the angel that spake to him in the Mount Sinai, and with our fathers who received the lively oracles to give unto us. When I really looked at what was contained in those verses, I felt like they were kind of a list of the proofs that God had put into Moses and into his life so that the people would know who he was and that they would be able to follow him because of knowing that. So in verse 36, we have the declaration here from on Stephen's part of the things that these people he was talking to knew very well. That God had, through Moses, performed signs and wonders in service to the people, and he had also empowered him to lead a successful exodus out of Egypt. That wasn't an easy thing to do for a man, and so the power of God definitely was involved in that and showed forth to the people, especially when they came to the Red Sea. In verse 37, where he points out, he talks about this resemblance again between him and Jesus. We looked at that last week in Deuteronomy 18. It's in verses 15 through 18. We looked at it last week in Deuteronomy, but here we'll just have it again in the way that Moses, that Stephen says it here in verse 37, that a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren like unto me, him shall ye hear. God had caused Moses, the events and the things that happened to him in his life and the things that he did, God had caused him to bear these resemblances to Jesus. He had put those features into Moses' life so that people would be able to recognize the Messiah when he came. It was meant to be a help to them, a foreshadowing to them of how they would know the Messiah and who he was. So just like Moses had credentials, Jesus had them too. In verse 38, this is he that was in the church in the wilderness with the angel that spake to him in the Mount Sinai and with our fathers who received the lively oracles to give unto him. This was that who again, who received the lively oracles is again Moses. And this is the evidence that Stephen has that God spoke to the people through Moses. And that it was through Moses that God delivered their covenant to them, delivered the law to them. And Stephen calls these the words of life. Lively oracles just means living words, which is really, truly something only God has. He is the only one who has the words of life. They can't come from any other source. When with these verses, Stephen has done a pretty good job of proving that Moses was the leader that God had given the people for this exodus and for their entry into the promised land. But even with all that power and demonstration, Moses was still rejected by those he was sent to save. And we have that in verse 39. Acts 7 verse 39 says, to whom our fathers would not obey, but thrust him from them and in their hearts turned back again to Egypt. So Stephen didn't leave any doubts about this likeness to Jesus either, the likeness of being rejected by those to whom he was sent. Last week we read John 5, 45 and 47. I think we could turn to that again quickly just to remind ourselves. John 5, 45. Which is Jesus speaking to people who had been listening to and questioning some of his teachings. And he says, do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuseth you, even Moses, in whom ye trust. For For had ye believed Moses, you would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if ye believe not his writings, how shall you believe my words? So that's a real telling thing for us to understand why Moses' life was designed the way that it was and contained the things that it was. It was for this purpose, that having understood Moses to be their deliverer from Egypt, that they would be able to also recognize their permanent and final deliverer in the Messiah. So, and the same thing had happened to Jesus when his teachings were challenged by those people who were following him and hearing the various things that he did and benefiting from the miracles he did, especially the loaves and fishes. If you just turn a few pages over to John 6, John 6 in verse 60, so towards the very end of that chapter. John 6:60 says, many therefore of his disciples, when they had heard this, said, this is a hard saying, who can hear it? And this is, of course, when Jesus was describing the, he had described to them the manner of his death, he basically describes what will become communion, but he's describing on a spiritual level, the partaking of his suffering and death. And this was found to be a hard saying, something that was not something that they felt they wanted to have happen to them, and something that would to be required of them. So if we keep on, go on, however, let's see what the disciples, the 12 who were following him and whoever else of the called disciples that were with him that day, what their response was. In verse 66, we read, from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him, because the saying was too hard for them. Verse 67, then said Jesus unto the 12, will you also go away? Then Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life. And we believe and are sure that thou art that Christ, the Son of the living God, which is exactly what those living oracles, the lively oracles that Stephen describes that came down from the mountain, were meant to teach them, both through the way that they demonstrated who Moses was and then also in training them how to walk godly in their lives before God. So I want to think a little bit about the rejection that we're talking about here. The disciples here had just proved that faith could overcome that, and that they could recognize the words of living water and the bread, living bread that Jesus had for them. But I really wanted to think about what it means for the Hebrews in the wilderness to have rejected Moses, and for the people we just read about here to have rejected Jesus and walked away. I just wanted to think about really what was so objectionable about Moses. And we have a little bit of a description of him, and we don't know a great deal of detail, but we really don't have to guess nevertheless, because we've already read it once here in Acts. Back in Egypt, the put down had been, who made you a ruler and a judge? The rest of the sentence being over us. Who made you? A kid today would say, who made you the boss of me? Is what we would probably hear today. And that persisted even when Moses had led them out successfully out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, and they were living from day to day under God's provision to them, and yet that attitude still persisted. And just one example of that we can turn to is in Numbers. This one I think might be familiar to you. Numbers 12. So this is while they've been traveling for a while. In Numbers 12, the first verse, it says, and Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, hath the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not spoken also by us? And the Lord heard it. And this results ultimately in Miriam being stricken with leprosy, which God mercifully limited to 7 days. It wasn't the rest of her life, but This is a rebellion and a rejection of him. It's the same. It's saying the same thing. Who made you to be over us? And both of those complaints, the one we had back in Egypt, and now that they're out of Egypt, we have it again, and it occurs in other places. And the example of Korah is one of them, if you're familiar with that. Both of these complaints really boil down to, who do you think you are? It's the complaint of someone who doesn't want to be under authority. And if it were just another human being who was lording it over her, that might make some sense to us. But when we think about it carefully, we realize that the problem never really was Moses. The problem was that Moses embodied God's dominion over his people. It was God's rightful position and they were his possession, they were his creation, and he had covenanted with them, and that's what they're rejecting the whole time. They rejected in the person of Moses, as Stephen brings it out here, because they rejected it in the person of all of the prophets that brought this message to them through the years, and whom they persecuted. They rejected in the form of Jesus, and now they're doing the same thing to Stephen. So we're back to Acts. Let's turn back there again. Acts 39. So it says that, to whom our fathers would not obey, but thrust him from them, and in their hearts turned back again to Egypt. I wanted to look into that a little bit as well. Just to take a quick look at what their life had really been like in Egypt and how it was described. And for this, we need to go back to Genesis. Genesis 47, please. And let's start in verse 56. And when we're done with this one, just hang on to it, because we're just going to turn a few more pages to read a little more. Genesis 47, starting in verse 5, we get the original description of what they were given when they came into the land of Egypt, when God had provided for them again, already for them to survive the famine that was throughout the land, by the totally amazing life that he invested in Joseph. But here we are in verse 5, and Pharaoh spoke unto Joseph, whom he favored very deeply, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. Verse 6, the land of Egypt is before thee, in the best of the land, make thy father and thy brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell, and if thou knowest any men of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. He gave them land, he gave them a way to make a living, he gave them positions to do the work that needed to be done there. And then if we go over to verse 27 in this same chapter, so we're still in Genesis 47, verse 27, it says, and Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt and in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein and grew and multiplied exceedingly. This is a people who is prospering in the lands that were given to them by the Pharaoh. And then let's just turn over to Exodus 1, just a couple pages over, Exodus 1. And here's the description of how much they had prospered and how well they had done there. In verse 7 of chapter 1 in Exodus, says, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceedingly great, exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. So they were, it kind of sounds like they were doing better than the Egyptians in many ways, which is precisely what causes the problem that results in children like Moses being, boys like that were born to them like Moses being cast out. Because the Egyptians start to feel threatened by them, and these various oppressions in the form of very hard labor for their way of making a living, and then ultimately this solution of trying to get rid of their children was the Egyptians' way of trying to stop the Israelites from becoming an even greater people than they already were, and definitely to stop them from becoming greater from the Egyptians, or greater than the Egyptians. So it's then when the oppression starts and when the victimization starts, that's when Israel starts to cry out to God. It's not while the things are going good. It's not when they're settled in the land of Goshen and they have all the things that they need and their numbers are growing and their wealth is growing and they have everything that there is to want in this natural life. And it's when that goes away that they start to cry out to God. And God does hear them then. I had always, for some reason in my mind, had always thought that when they cried out to God, it was to ask them to bring them out of Israel, out of Egypt, to get them into the country that he had promised to them and get them away from the oppression. They'd had at least 80 years of that, because from the time that Moses was born to the time that he comes back is 80 years. You would think that'd be enough time for actually resentment and hatred towards Egypt to have arisen in their hearts. But I realized at a certain point reading this that it wasn't being taken away from Egypt that they really wanted. It wasn't leaving Egypt. They just wanted things to go back to the way that they had been before. They had enjoyed that way of life. It had been comfortable and secure and prosperous and all of the things that appeal to our human natures and our physical bodies and wants. So that answer that God gave them was slightly different from the one that maybe they asked for. They wanted things to be the way that they had been before they became hard. So it makes it a little easy for them to remember Egypt in a fond way and in a way that overlooks the oppression. It seems like it's fairly simple for them to start to forget that part. Let's turn to Numbers, the 11th chapter. Numbers 11, verses 4 through 6. So here's just, I'm going to just read one example, although there are several that we could read. But here's just one of the examples of how that process of kind of rewriting their history in Egypt occurred. So Numbers 11, verse 4 says, "And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting, and the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlics. But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes.'" So God had brought them out of Egypt, brought them through the Red Sea, brought them this far, had provided for this vast number of people to be fed every single day. But the glory of the things that he had done for them really paled in their minds to the way that they remembered Egypt and the way that they idealized it in their minds. So there are other places that this happens, that I won't turn to that now just for the sake of time. But what we want to remember about it again is that this complaint isn't really against Moses, because Moses is standing before them on God's behalf. And so this complaint is really against God, that what he has given them is not enough. It's not good enough, and it isn't what they wanted. And so in reality, it's as if their hearts had never really left Egypt. They longed for the things that they had known, the comforts they had enjoyed, and they weren't after this life in God. They weren't after the things of God, as long as those things stood so upfront in their minds. So they hadn't followed Moses out of Egypt because they longed for God's promises to Abraham to be fulfilled. If anything, they left on the premise that he was their God, they had a covenant with him, he owed him a good life, and now let's let him produce it for us, and we'll follow him in order to let him do that. But it wasn't a desire for the reality of who God really was. They don't want him for who he really is. So in verse 40. Let's get back to Acts again. I know we're turning back to the Old Testament a lot this time. I noticed I got markers in my Bible and it's really crowded up front. this time, verse 40 in Acts 7. Really brings us, Stephen brings the council here to one of the lowest low points of their shared history and of the performance of their forefathers out in the wilderness. So when they turned their hearts back to Egypt, in verse 40, they were saying unto Aaron, make us gods to go before us. For as for this Moses, which brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know, we wot not what is become of him. Such an interesting pairing of things to have in that verse. It never ceases to kind of shock me. This Moses, which brought us out of the land of Egypt, and everything that was involved in doing that, we don't know what happened to him. We need God to be present with us, and so make us something that we can worship, make us something we can pray to, something that we can offer sacrifices to, because we need to bring that power back into our midst. They're very confused about what it is that Moses is bringing to them and about what they are asking for here. So they had just pledged, I won't turn to this one, but I'll give you the reference for it. In Exodus 24, verses 7 through 7 and 8, is when they have just listened to Moses declare God's, the beginnings of God's law to them. It's not the whole expansion of it, but it's this after he's come down out of the mountain the first time. He has read those things to him and explained some of them to them, and they have pledged themselves to him to obey them. And that's Exodus 24, verses 7 and 8. Then Moses goes back up into the mountains, and he's gone for several weeks. The amount of time it took him to go up the mountain, and now it's been 40 days since they have seen him disappear into this, what looks like a ball of fire up on the mountainside. And they take this as a reason to take things into their own hands, and all pretense of trusting in God has been set aside at this time, so that the people told Aaron to make idols for them, as we just read. And they don't do this in ignorance. They don't do this without knowing what God had told them about how he felt about idols. And every Jew, including the Sanhedrin that is listening to Stephen this day, any Jew who'd ever read or heard the Torah knew that this act was not done in ignorance, and we can confirm that. Let's turn to Exodus 20. Exodus 20, and of course it's towards the beginning of these commandments, starting in verse 4. Thou shalt make, this is what Moses had brought down from the mountain to tell them from God. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, in verse 6, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. This is one of the things that the people who were listening had agreed to and accepted and pledged themselves to do, to obey. And if you drop down to verse 22 in the same chapter, Exodus 20, verse 22, here I found this to be a really helpful thing to read too. This is a description from God of how they can approach him. They're not to make an image that they call by his name or by any other name. They're not to do that, but he does give them a way to approach them, and yet we can read about it here. It's a very worthwhile thing to read. So Exodus 20, verse 22 through 26. And the Lord said unto Moses, thus thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, You have seen that I have talked to you, with you from heaven. You shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall you make unto you gods of gold. An altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and shall sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen. In all the places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Verse 26, neither shalt thou go up by steps unto my altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon. This was such a strong difference between this and the thing that they had built. They haven't done it at this point, but the thing that they built when Moses was in the mountain, and when they brought all their gold to Aaron, their jewelry and whatnot, to be melted down and made into this image of a golden calf, and then having the things of God to be celebrated at the feet of this idol. Because when God told them what he wanted for an altar, it's an extremely simple thing. It's just earth. It's just dirt piled up high enough that the things that the sacrifice require can be done. They aren't even to make steps up to it. So it can't be very tall. It can't be very big, or you'd need some steps to be able to use it. And he doesn't even want steps, because just the touch of their physical bodies is going to defile it. And the same thing of the work of their hands. If they're going to use rocks, he wants it to be his handiwork, not theirs, that is used for this. And it's not to be harsh to them. It's because he's letting them know who he is. The first thing he does is say, I spoke to you from heaven. Through Moses, I spoke to you from heaven. They're to understand how very different he is than any god that they have ever encountered in Egypt or in their past, in any the gods of Canaan and whatnot that they were familiar with in the surrounding people back before they came into Egypt. Nothing that they've experienced is going to help them understand and see who God is. So this is just one small means that he gives them to let him know how holy he is and how other he is from the physical things that they, as we know, as we just read, they go ahead and they identify with. They want that thing in front of them that they can look at. And they treat God with that idol as if he was one of those little G gods who put on a big show, build a big fancy throne, you make an opulent altar to attract him, and they'll come. And you say the right words and you go through the right motions, and he will do what you want him to do. And God says, with me, it's not like that. Don't make an altar like that to me. Don't even put your foot on it. He doesn't want them to think about him in that way at all, because it separates them from the true glory of the things that he is wanting to do for them, that he's entirely able to do for them, and the glory that he's set before them as a nation and as the children of a faithful person like Abraham. So he doesn't want them to make a mistake about who it is they're dealing with. But they do find a way to do that. And here, as we've read here in Acts, which we can turn back to again, Acts 7. In verse 41, with Moses has just been gone a few weeks now, and they've really trespassed everything that God had told them and that they had agreed to obey. In verse 41 it says, and they made a calf in those days and offered sacrifice unto the idol and rejoiced in the works of their own hand, the work that God didn't even want to put onto a stone if it was going to be put into an altar for him. This is what they're glorying in, that they have made this amazing thing. And so they've just dishonored him on every front and treated him like the kind of God that they want him to be, and not the kind of God that he really is. So there's so many things that we could study here about this, and I don't know how many of these things are really familiar to you or not, but to try to keep this focus on what Stephen is doing. We're going to continue to move on here with Stephen as he moves into the final trajectory of his of what he has to say to the council members who were sitting in front of him. So I wanted to look at verses 42 and 43. So let's read those. And this gets us into question three. So verse 42 says, from this idol worship, the next we read the next verse. Then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven, as it is written in the books of the prophets, O ye house of Israel, have ye offered to me slain beasts and sacrificed by the space of 4 years in the wilderness? Yea, you took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your god Remphan, figures which you made to worship them, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. This is a quote that Stephen has used. These aren't his own words. And it's an interesting time for him to decide to quote one of the prophets. But this is a quote of the prophet Amos in chapter 5 of Amos, which he's got it pretty much word for word here. So it's Amos 5, 25 through 27, if you want to read it there. So what I ended up thinking about these verses, because there's a lot going on here. If you start with just in verse 42 to say straight from building the golden calf to then God turned, we know that God actually dealt with them for hundreds of years before this complete turning away and letting them be led into captivity, and that ended up in the destruction of the temple that he eventually allowed them to build. There's quite a bit of time that goes on there. So I ended up looking at this as if Stephen kind of collapsed all of those transgressions into these few verses. He doesn't name them out one by one. It would be a long recitation for him to give. And he starts with that original idolatry there in the wilderness. And then he covers everything else, everything that happened in Canaan when they didn't get rid of the other people and their gods that were already in the land. God had instructed them to do that, but they didn't do it thoroughly. God had told them that because he knew that the presence of those things would be a temptation to them. So when they didn't do it, they were stuck with that temptation being in front of their faces all the time. One of the other ones being the marriages that they formed with people outside of God's people who had strange gods, and a wife or a husband would feel like they either needed to or found it convenient to serve their purposes to make that spouse happy by allowing that god to be worshipped in their household or by their household. So he encompasses all of these things, and I spent a little bit of time, not a great deal, and I'll explain that in just a minute, looking up what these gods were, the ones that he actually names out, because when you read the Old Testament, you read a lot of names of these strange gods that the Canaanites and other people around them had, and one of them that occurs a great deal is Baal, and we don't see him named here, but there's relationships between all of these names, and they're called different things in different parts of the country and things like that. So, but I honestly, as I studied it, I felt like I got a tiny taste of what God felt when he watched these things happen, because it's disgusting. It's just, I really had found that I had some limits on how much time and energy I could put into studying paganism. It's all coming out of a human being's imagination, or coming out of Satan's mind, or both at the same time, and I just don't feel obliged to get my head around it. And interestingly, in a minute we'll read a scripture about that, so I'll hold off on that one. What I did find was that everything I needed to know is covered in the Bible, and I want to turn to it, Romans the first chapter. Explains this to us pretty well. Romans, the first chapter, starting in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. having those living words and yet not taking them into your life and making them your life. Verse 19, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, his creation, in other words, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Looking to the natural things of God's creation and treating them as if they were the same as him or even above him or more than him doesn't make any sense. What is created can't be greater than that which created it. So this leaves us without excuse, and it left them the same way. Even the pagans who had not known any of these things still had an obligation to look at creation and know that there was a power far beyond anything that they could make with their hands that had created all of these things and took responsibility for it. Verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. And we can continue reading here, but I feel like that kind of is the explanation for what paganism is and what and other forms of trying to sidestep who it is that we really have to deal with. To know him, but not glorify him as God, to put something else on a par with him or even above him. And this is not a temptation that has ever left man alone. It wasn't solved by a Babylonian captivity or anything else. So there is just one thing that I feel we need to mention here about the particular gods that Stephen names in his quote of Amos. And that is another disgusting thing, which is that they were associated with child sacrifice. And I found that in Leviticus. I'm going to just give you this so that you can check it yourself when it's convenient, if you want to. It's found in Leviticus 18, verse 21. This god Molech is specifically tied to that. And it's elsewhere too, but that's a convenient place to see it. And I'm not delving into that one either, but I do want to look at Deuteronomy 12. Deuteronomy 12, verse 30. Deuteronomy, that's a hard word to say. 12, verse 30 says, take heed to thyself that thou be not snared by following them. This is these pagan religions. After that they be destroyed from before thee. So that was his commandment to them, was to get rid of them when they came into this country and not follow them after they were driven out in front of them. And that thou inquire not after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. So that verse makes me feel like my feeling that I don't owe it to these beliefs to look into them deeply and to really try and get my head around them and understand what they were thinking. I don't feel like I owe that to them. And this is one of the reasons why. In verse 31, it says, thou shalt not do so unto the Lord thy God, for every abomination to the Lord which he hateth have they done unto their gods. Not to their gods as an object, but on behalf of, or we would probably say they've done that for their gods. For even their sons and their daughters have they burnt in the fire for their gods. So this is a particularly offensive thing in God's eyes for the obvious reasons that we know that children are a heritage to us as human beings. But the other thing about it is that it's one of Satan's imitations of the things of God. And it's meant to mock into the sacrifice that Jesus made for us, and it's meant to distract people from it. And so we do need to know what it is in order to understand how strong a charge that Stephen was laying at the feet of the people that he was talking to. And in a nutshell, I felt like verses 41 through 43 here in Acts 7 was just very simply saying, as your forefathers began, so they continued, and so has come forward to this day, the idolatrous, the rebellious, over and over again. And these were the forefathers that the council that Stephen was talking to were that was their source of pride and their source of entitlement to the positions that they had, and this source was wickedly flawed, and over again God had dealt with them on this, and they had always returned to it. So that was in fact really the cause of the destruction of the temple, which they're now accusing Stephen of blaspheming the temple. This is now the second temple, the one that they're sitting in, as they examine Stephen here and listen to his response to them. That one was built when they returned from that captivity and had to rebuild the temple in the city of Jerusalem because it had been destroyed in that process. And this rejection is still about not wanting to be under the authority of their creator. And so that's the thread that Stephen draws through all of this, and that resistance, that rejection of the people that God gave authority to, the people that God gave his word to bring to his people, it's not just a rejection of that person. It's a rejection of the God who empowered that person and who God chose to do that work for him. And as I studied all of this, I kept hearing a little echo in my head of this attitude, and I thought we should turn to that too in order to end tonight. And let's in Revelations 3. Revelations 3, and if you just glance at verse 14, you'll see that this is the part of Revelations, the letter that was written to the church at Laodicea. But we're going to read from verse 17 and 18 because this is the part that kind of kept ringing in my mind as I read about all of the attitude of rejecting God's authority over them. Well, I'm going to start at 15, where he says to this church, which is the final church in the dispensation that we are in now, "I know thy works, that thou art neither hot nor cold. I would thou wert hot or cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Because thou sayest, I am rich, I am increased with goods, and I have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable, and poor and blind and naked." That's the part that I kept hearing of the people and the actions that Stephen was recounting to the Sanhedrin this day, was especially the idolatry, the opulence of creating an idol and decorating it with your jewelry and having all your rites take and rituals take place around it, and that to think that that was glorious, that the works of your hands were somehow something that you could rejoice in and glory in, when instead they were wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked before God. And I can't leave off from here, however, without reading verse 18, because he doesn't leave this here in Revelations for that final church of the dispensation of grace to end on. He offers this to that church. Verse 18, "I counsel thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, so you won't be poor anymore, that thou may be rich, and white raiment that thou mayest be clothed, and that the shame of thy nakedness do not appear, and anoint thy eyes with eye salve, that thou mayest see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous therefore, and repent." this attitude of not needing to follow God, not needing a savior, not needing a deliverer, is not something that's ever gone away, never will go away for mankind until all temptation is removed. But these words also contain hope. They show us God's willingness to heal his people, to repair the damage that they've done to our relationships with him and with one another. And it's a constant process, just like Liz brought out on Sunday. But it's our hope. That constant process is our hope, and that constant maintenance of the wealth and the clothing of righteousness and the eyes that are able to see him and follow him, that's a constant process for him, but it's also the hope of our salvation. And I just want to leave you with that and let you know that the next question in our study guide is question 4, and it's going to cover verses 44 to 49. I think that it will be posted shortly on the in full on the website, and it's a little hard to read out, so I'm going to let you read it there. But it asks about God's relationship with the tabernacle in the wilderness and with the temple. And just keep it in mind here that Stephen had well proved to these men who were sitting in front of him, from the scriptures he had done this. He'd proved to them that their forefathers had resisted and persecuted God's messengers because they resisted God himself and refused him the lordship that was rightly his over them. They wanted to contain and limit a limitless God. And Stephen has more to say about that in the next few verses. So I thank you and ask God to bless you and bless your family and whoever it is that you're sheltering in place with, and keep you all safe. Thank you.